the 9th. The lecture is entitled Difference Between Absorption, Concentration, and Tranquility Meditation by Venerable Bhante Vimana.
Oh, you're right.
Can you hear me? Okay. It's a great honor to invite Venerable Bhante Vimana from Washington, D.C. to stay with us for 2 weeks or so, and not only teach us, but actually conduct a weekend retreat with us. So before we even start, I'd like to briefly introduce his personal experience and learning of the Dharma. This contains more information than the one you saw from your flyer, all right? In 1975, October, Venerable was first interested in meditation. And he did the meditation, a practice of a Burmese style of meditation called Vipassana in San Diego, California. And then later he went to San Jose, California area and began practicing meditation with a former Sri Lanka monk and wound up staying that center for about a year and a half. There he met and practiced with an Indian teacher by the name of Muindra, who practiced in Burma for 9 years. And this teacher is very famous. At that time when he learned meditation from Mr. Muindra, he did very intensive meditation, about 16 hours a day, alternating walking and sitting every hour. Muindra is a famous meditation teacher who was the teacher of Mr. Joseph Goldstein. And then went to Hawaii, began teaching some meditation class to a few people. After 2 years, Venerable went to come back to mainland states so he could do meditation while working with people who are dying. Over the states, he started to start a hospice and worked teaching people who are dying and how to meditate and open up the experience of dying. After about a year of doing this meritorious work, Venerable went to San Francisco and stayed as a layperson in Burmese monastery with a world-famous teacher by the name of Wood Shinananda. And he practiced with this Venerable for 2 years, still practicing Vipassana meditation style. And in 1986, he decided to go to Asia and begin practicing meditation in a very intensive way. He went to Thailand and became a monk. That's about 1986. Over there, he practiced with many different teachers. In 1988, he went to the famous meditation center called Mahasi Center in Rangoon, of which country? Burma. There he did an 8-month very intensive meditation retreat for 22 hours a day. At this time, this country was going through some very hard social conditions, and they had a revolution. So the government asked all foreign monks to leave the country. So he left the country and went for Malaysia and began teaching meditation at a center that he started. In 1990, he came back to Burma and did a 2-year intensive retreat, walking and sitting meditation for about 18 hours a day. There, the teacher asked students to extend the sitting, so Venerable at that time actually sit for long periods of time, and each time 5 to 8 hours without moving the body. So he has a wonderful experience there, and later he left and went back to Malaysia and began teaching meditation to many people. There are a lot of other details. I think I'm going to make it short. Basically, he also teach many Asian students and very successful, particularly with Malaysian people, overseas Chinese people from Malaysia. Over 1,000 students. Sometimes a lecture will have audience about 500 people. That's pretty common to him. So it's a great honor that we have him to give us his teaching and direct us how to meditate. So, I'll leave this to Venerable.
The first question I want to ask is, what is meditation? So many people have so many different kinds of ideas of, I want to do meditation so I can gain personal power and make people do what I want them to. I want to do meditation so I can fly in the air or read other people's minds. I want to do meditation so I can learn how to be a great healer. I want to do meditation so that I can work with all different kinds of energy, not only in my body, but other people's bodies. I want to do meditation so I can learn to become calm, become peaceful. So there's a lot of different aspects of what people think meditation is. What the Buddha was talking about when he was talking about meditation was teaching us how to let go of unwholesome states being lust or hatred, delusion, and to develop very wholesome states of mind, happiness, joy, freedom. The way that the Buddha taught is there are so many different styles of meditation that quotes are Buddhist these days, that what I've done is I've gone back to the original teaching of the Buddha, and I found that basically there are two different kinds of meditation. One kind of meditation is done by probably about 99% of all the people in the world, and that is one-pointed absorption kinds of meditation. The other kind of meditation, which is actually what the Buddha was talking about, is a tranquility kind of meditation. Now, when I say 99% of the people are practicing this one-pointed meditation, I mean it's not only Buddhists, it's Christians, it's Muslims, it's the Hindus. All of the different kinds of religion, they teach one form or another of the one-pointed concentration. But the Buddha was a little bit different. When you practice one-pointed concentration, let's say you put your attention on the breath, and your mind becomes distracted. So you're watching the breath, and your mind goes away. When you practice one-pointed concentration, what you do is you let go of that distraction and immediately come back to the breath. Now, when you practice the way the Buddha taught, there's a little difference. In the sutta itself, it says that you experience the entire body on the in-breath and on the out-breath, and you tranquilize the bodily formation on the in-breath and the out-breath. Now, what does this mean? It means that you're not focusing deeply just on the breath. It means that what you're doing is you're using the breath as the reminder to relax tightness and tension in your body. And one of the places that nobody ever seems to really see is the tightness that happens in your head. And you have to learn how to relax that. So there's a little bit of a difference. Say you're practicing the breathing meditation, but on the in-breath you're relaxing, on the out-breath you're relaxing your body. And your mind gets distracted. It goes away. As soon as you notice that your mind has gone away from the meditation, then let it go and relax. Relax that tightness that's caused from the distraction itself, the tightness in your head. Feel your mind open up and become calm. And then gently redirect your attention back to the breath. On the in-breath, relax. On the out-breath, relax. So you can see that this is a little bit different. When you're practicing one-pointed concentration, what you're doing is when you have that distraction and you let go and you bring your mind back to your object of meditation, you're bringing back some tightness and tension. This one extra step of relaxing changes the entire meditation. When you practice one-pointed concentration, your mind will go very deep in concentration and it will stay glued to your object of meditation, say the breath. It will just stay there. And you lose all feeling in the body. You don't hear anything outside. Now, when I was in Thailand, there was a little 12-year-old boy that he was very good at one-pointed concentration. And they wanted to test him, so they brought him to the monastery where I was staying. And he sat in meditation, he got into this deep state, and the teacher came with some chopsticks and hit him on the head. He didn't feel it. The teacher got a very loud bell right by his ear. Bang! He didn't hear it. The teacher would move his arms so that his arms would be up like this. And eventually his arms would just come down. When they touched some part of his body, he would relax. And he didn't know that that was happening. Now this is what happens when you practice one-pointed concentration. One of the disadvantages of having this kind of deep concentration is that not only do you lose sensation in your body, you don't hear anything when you get into the deep states, but you also suppress or you stop the hindrances from arising. Hindrances, you can see them here. Lust, hatred, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. Now, the force of the concentration will push down and not allow these hindrances to arise while you're sitting in deep concentration. But when you get up from that concentration and you start doing your daily activities, these hindrances will come and they will attack you. And your awareness of these hindrances is not very good. Now, these are called hindrances, and this basically is any emotional state that arises. This is general terms, but you can put in there fear, depression, sadness, whatever emotional state you want. They're all different forms of these kind of hindrances. When you really go deep into your meditation, and it pushes these down. You're not learning how to purify your mind. And when you get out of the meditation, these hindrances will come, and you can be real emotional if something happens. Somebody comes up and they scold you, and you don't like that. And what happens in your mind? Your mind gets hard, just like a rock. And you think of all the things that you'd like to say to that person. You might bite your tongue and not say anything, but the emotion is still there. And the dislike of the emotion is still there. And the dissatisfaction of that is what the Buddha called in Pali, dukkha, suffering. Now, when somebody comes up and they scold you, whether you say anything to them or not, and they go away, what do you think about? Oh, what I should have said to that person. I'm right for doing things the way I'm doing it. They're wrong for criticizing me. You have all of these kind of thoughts. And an interesting thing is, because of your ego attachment to these thoughts and feelings, they will come up again and again in the same order with exactly the same words, just like it's on a tape deck. Anytime you have repeat thoughts, though your mind is trying to show you where you are attached, and where your mind has grabbed on to thoughts and feelings and took them very personally. And your mind gets tighter and tighter. And this is what is commonly called in this country stress. So how do you overcome stress? How do you overcome these kind of problems? When you begin practicing tranquility meditation, you will not go as deeply into the concentration as you do with one-pointed concentration. Now this is kind of tricky because there's a lot of Pali words that are used by a lot of people to describe different kinds of mental states. Now, one of the words that's used is jhana. And the Hindus practice jhana. Jhana, they will tell you, means one-pointed concentration. They will tell you that it means deep concentration. But in reality, the word jhana, if you want to spell it, it's J-H-A-N-A. Jhana means a meditation level, a stage of meditation. That's all jhana means. It doesn't have anything to do with concentration. Now, another word that is used and misunderstood by 99% of the people is the word samadhi. Samadhi is a Pali word. Sama means tranquil. Di means wisdom. Samadhi, tranquil wisdom. That's the literal meaning of this word. But because when the English language, when the Pali was turned into the English language at the turn of the last century, it was done by scholars that had no concept of what meditation was. They used the word concentration for samadhi. And because that was the way they started, it's continued on and on and on. But actually, the word samadhi is not concentration at all. The word word samadhi means a collected mind, a calm peaceful mind, a mind that is not distracted, a mind that's very still. It does not mean one-pointed concentration, as the Hindus, when they right after the Buddha died, they started taking a lot of the language that the Buddha used and gave it different definitions. And even today, you'll see meditation books or magazines at the bookstore that will talk about samadhi. And the samadhi they're talking about is one-pointed concentration. Now, an interesting thing is that the word samadhi was never used before the Buddha used it. He made this word up. There was many different forms of one-pointed concentration being practiced at that time. But he used the word samadhi to describe a very particular kind of mental development. It didn't have anything to do with one-pointed concentration. He wanted a different word that had a completely different meaning, and the word he chose was samadhi. And the word samadhi means peacefulness, stillness, calmness, composure. The best word probably is collectedness, when your mind is very collected. Another Pali word that is very much misunderstood, I don't know if you've heard this one or not, it's called samatha. Samatha is always defined as being one-pointed concentration. And the literal translation of samatha is tranquility, serenity, peacefulness, calmness. So all of these different Pali words have been changed and inserted in a lot of different kinds of meditation. And it makes things very confusing. The Buddha did not teach one-pointed concentration ever. He tried that as a bodhisattva in his last lifetime, and he went as far as he could possibly go. And he went all the way to the realm of neither perception nor non-perception with one-pointed concentration, but he couldn't go any further. And he went away from the teacher kind of shaking his head, saying, that's not Nibbana, there's got to be something else. When he started practicing the meditation, he practiced many, many different kinds of meditation as a bodhisattva. He practiced not taking food. He thought that purifying the body would lead to purifying the mind, but he found out that that's not necessarily true. He practiced holding his breath for long periods of time. And when he held his breath for long periods of time, he had amazing pains come into his body. Like somebody had a strap around his head and they would twist it, and it kept getting tighter and tighter and tighter. It didn't bother his mind, but it tired his body out. On the night that he became enlightened, he sat down and he started reflecting on all of the different ways that he practiced meditation in his lifetime to see if he might have missed something. And he remembered when he was a very young boy. He was 1.5 or 2 years old. And he was at a plowing festival. His father was the king, and they went out and they plowed the fields and they had a big party. And the people, the women that were supposed to be taking care of them, left him alone. And he started practicing meditation. And he practiced this tranquility, this opening and relaxing, opening and relaxing. And he got into the first jhana, the first meditation level, which was very amazing. So on the night of his enlightenment, he started reflecting about that, and he realized this is the way. Every other way that I've practiced meditation is one form or another of the one-pointed concentration. And when you practice one-pointed concentration, you contract your mind a little bit, and then you focus very deeply. But what the Buddha saw was when you practice the tranquility meditation, you open up your mind and relax. So it's very much different. There's always this opening and relaxing on the in-breath, on the out-breath, distraction, open and relax, let it go, come back to the breath, in-breath, relax, out-breath, relax. And this was how he attained enlightenment, by practicing this kind of meditation. There's a lot of people right now that have the idea that mindfulness is some kind of meditation that's different than the tranquility meditation. The Buddha taught many different forms of meditation. He taught loving-kindness meditation. He taught foulness of the body meditation. He taught the element meditation, earth, wind, fire, air. He taught kasina, which is a big disc like this kind of meditation with different colors. He taught a lot of different kinds of meditation, but the only thing that was different from one meditation to the other was the object that you were focusing on. Every kind of meditation that the Buddha taught was a tranquility type of meditation. And the tranquility type of meditation does lead to different meditation levels, stages. Now, when you get to the first meditation stage, what happens is there is a lot of joy arising. In the joy, there's five different kinds of joy according to Buddhism. The first three kinds of joy arise for anyone at any time. It doesn't matter who or what they are, or what they're doing. These are called mundane. The first kind of joy is like having a real happy thought or something happy happening to you, and you have goose flesh, goosebumps on your skin. And it's there for a moment and disappears. Now the next kind of joy that arises is like a flash of lightning. It's very intense. It's there for a moment, disappears. The next kind of joy is called, being in the ocean and having a wave of joy just come over you, and then another wave. And this is very pleasant. And it lasts for a little bit longer period of time, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, like that. Now, the last two kinds of joy only arise through mental development. And the next kind of joy is called uplifting joy. And the kind of joy, when this arises, you generally have let go of some kind of attachment. And there's a very big relief that occurs. And then your mind feels very, very light. And your body feels very, very light. And you're happy. And that happy feeling lasts for quite a period of time. Now, no matter what kind of joy that arises, always right after that joy, there is a period of tranquility where you feel very peaceful and very calm. When you get to this uplifting joy. This uplifting joy can last for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes. And after it fades away, that peaceful, calm mind can last for an hour, hour and a half. And your mind doesn't move. Your mind stays on your object of meditation. It does it naturally. This is what they call effortless effort. It doesn't take any effort at all. Your mind just, it doesn't feel like moving. It just stays there. And you feel more peace and more equanimity than you've ever felt in your life. Very nice. The last kind of joy is called all-pervading joy. Now what the artist is showing with the open eyes is this last kind of joy. While you're sitting, you feel joy popping out of everywhere. It's just every cell in your body is happy. And your eyes open up. And you notice that and you say, oh, the eyes are open. And you close them and they open up again by themselves. And that's what the artist is showing when he's showing that. After this kind of joy, the tranquility can last for long periods of time. 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours, like that. And you don't feel like moving. You're so comfortable. You're so much at peace and so calm that you'll just sit there. Your mind is very, very alert. Your mind is very much in the present moment. If there are sounds, you hear them. But it doesn't make your mind shake. It doesn't make your mind go to that sound. You just hear the sound, okay, that's a sound. And the mind stays peaceful and calm on your object of meditation. Someone can come up and they can touch you. And you would feel that. Now, I'm talking about being in the jhana. You remember what I was talking about before. In the one-pointed concentration, when you get into the jhana, you don't have any feeling in your body at all. But with this kind of tranquility, you are completely aware. There's no suppression of anything. But your mind has such a state of balance that it doesn't shake, it doesn't wobble, it recognizes, there's an ant walking on there, okay. No problem. Now, when you begin to meditate, you'll notice that your mind doesn't want to cooperate very much. Your mind wants to jump around here and jump around there, just like it always does. But that is not a problem. It's your active mind is not your enemy to fight. Okay, now let's say I'm going to give you the instructions on how to meditate right now. So You'll have an idea of what I'm talking about. In the instructions, now this is straight from the original teaching of the Buddha. It says, you understand when you have a long breath, on the in-breath you understand when it's long, on the out-breath you understand if it's a long breath. You understand on the in-breath, if you take a short breath, and you understand on the out-breath, if it's a short breath or not. Now this means you understand. It doesn't mean that you have to place your attention at any place in your body. See, there wasn't any description of you have to put your attention on your nostril tip, you have to put your attention on your abdomen, you have to glue your mind to this one place in your body. There's no mention of that. It just says, You know when you take a long breath. You know when you take a short breath. That's all. The next two lines of the instruction are most important. It says, on the in-breath, you experience the entire body. On the out-breath, you experience the entire body. On the in-breath, you tranquilize the bodily formation. On the out-breath, you tranquilize the bodily formation. So what is this really saying? It's saying that if you have tension anywhere in your body, let it go. Relax it on the in-breath and on the out-breath. So if you're sitting and your shoulders are up a little bit and you notice that, then relax them. Let go of all the tightness. Let go of all the tension. And also notice that tightness that is in your head, in your mind, and relax. Okay, that's part of your body too. So if you don't see any tension in the grosser part of your body, there's always going to be a little bit of tension in your mind. So relax. Feel your mind open up, expand, and then it takes a little step down. And that little step down is peaceful and calm. Always after you do this, you will notice that there is no thought in your mind at that time. And you bring that back to your breath. On the in-breath, do it again. And then bring it back to the breath. On the out-breath, do it again. So what you're doing is continually opening and calming, opening and calming. And there's no distracting thoughts right after you do that. But the nature of your mind is that you're going to be thinking about other things. If you had an active day, when you sit in meditation, why do you think that you wouldn't have an active mind while you're sitting? So as soon as you notice that your mind has gone away, you don't criticize yourself. You don't tighten around it. You say, okay, the truth is, mind has gone away. Fine. Let it go. Don't continue thinking. Just let the thought go. Even if you're in mid-sentence, let it go. Now notice the tightness in your head, in your body, and relax. And gently redirect your attention back to your object of meditation. That is the breath. On the in-breath, relax. On the out-breath, whoops, there it goes again. Okay, fine. Let it go. Relax. Come back. Relax. It doesn't matter how many times your mind wanders away. What matters is that when you have noticed that your mind has wandered away, that you let it go right then. You don't continue thinking. If you continue thinking, then you're not meditating anymore. So what you have to do is let go and relax. Come back to the breath. On the in-breath, relax. The out-breath, relax. Now, while you're sitting in meditation, you want to sit with your back nicely straight. It doesn't have to be rigid, but just nicely straight. And you sit in a posture that's comfortable. Some people have trouble sitting on the floor. There's no problem with that. Sit in a chair. Doesn't matter. What matters is what you're doing with your mind, more than the posture of your body. But you want your back nicely straight. And if you sit in a chair, don't sit where you're leaning real hard, because that's good for going to sleep and not meditating. And while you're sitting, you don't move your body. You don't wiggle your fingers. You don't wiggle your toes. You don't scratch. You don't rub. You don't change your posture. You don't rock. You don't move. You sit very still. You can sit as still as he does. You can move as much as he does. Now, while you're sitting like that, you will notice that there can be some sensations arise in your body. Sometimes it's an itch. Sometimes it's a heat or a vibration or a pain. Now, the truth is, when a sensation arises in your body, it is there. That's the truth. When it arises, you feel it, it's there. What you do with the truth of the present moment dictates what happens in the future. Karma. If you resist the present moment, if you don't like the present moment, if you try to control the present moment and be the way you want it to be, you can look forward to a lot of pain and suffering in the future. But if you lovingly accept what arises in the present moment without any resistance, you open up your mind and say, okay, there is a sensation there. Yes, it's unpleasant, and it's all right for it to be there. It has to be all right because the truth is it's there. Anytime you try to fight with the truth, causes you suffering. So what you do is you notice that there's a sensation, it's pulled your attention to it. And the first thing you'll notice is you have thoughts about the feeling. Now, you look up here at the five aggregates. You have feeling, and then you have thoughts about it. What we try to do is we continually try to think our feelings. But thoughts are one thing, and feelings are something else, and it doesn't work. So the first thing that we want to do is let go of the thoughts about the feeling. Those thoughts, I wish it would stop, I wish it would go away, why does it have to bother me now, all of those kind of thoughts. Let go of those thoughts, notice the tension and tightness in your head, in your mind, and relax. Now, you go to the feeling and you see there's a tight mental hold around that feeling. And that tight mental hold is aversion. I don't like it. I don't want it there. It's bothering me. But the truth is, it's there, and we have to learn how to lovingly accept it. So what we do is we let go of that tight mental hold and let that feeling float. Let it float in the air, just like it's a bubble. Wherever the wind blows, it'll go that way. It's okay. It doesn't matter. What you have to do is open up and relax. Allow that sensation to be there without trying to control it. And as you relax, then you redirect your attention back to the in-breath relax, the out-breath relax. And your mind goes back to that sensation, and it plays the same number again. You still have the thoughts about it, then you have to notice that, let thoughts go, relax. Notice that tight mental hold. Open up, relax. Come back to the breath. And you might bounce back and forth for a period of time with this. And that's okay. Every time you let go of a distraction and relax, you're building up your mindfulness. And it's like putting coins in a bank. Eventually the bank will get full, but at first it seems like it'll never get full. Your awareness of how this process works becomes better, more clear. Now, this mind and body is a process, okay? And it's made up of five different things. You can see up on top. You have body, physical body. You have feeling, perception, thoughts, and consciousness. Now, these are called aggregates. They're five different things that make up the body. And when you see them clearly, you see them as part of a process. When you see sensation arising, you're seeing there's physical body, you're also seeing feeling. And the perception is the recognition of what kind of feeling that is. If it's an itch, if it's a pain, whatever. Then you have the thoughts about it. So you have the consciousness of all of these things arising. When you become aware of these kind of distractions, that is called being mindful. Now, what is mindfulness? An interesting thing. If you look here, you have the four foundations of mindfulness. But you look at how closely they're related to the five aggregates. Body is the same. Feeling is the same. Consciousness and perception are part of consciousness. Thoughts are part of Dhamma. In other words, these four foundations of mindfulness and the five aggregates are different ways of saying the same thing. Now, when you're on your object of meditation and your mindfulness is real good, you can be in one of the jhanas, where you have a lot of joy and happiness and these kind of things. And then your mindfulness begins to weaken a little bit. And your attention starts to waver. As soon as that happens, you're no longer in the jhana. But now, you have one of these hindrances that you have to work with. Now the hindrances, even though we don't much like them, when they arise, are very important. Because this is where our real attachment is. You have lust or greed. I want. You have hatred or aversion. I don't want. You have sloth and torpor. I feel dull. You have restlessness, anxiety. I feel restless. You have doubt. I don't know. Now, each one of these has what we call the false idea of ego attachment. We believe that all of these feelings and thoughts that arise because of the hindrances are us. And we don't like it, and we want it to be different than it is. When you're practicing tranquility meditation, you can be sitting very nicely, and your mindfulness dips a little bit, and one of these hindrances can come up, or two or three sometimes. The restlessness can come up, and the dislike of the restlessness. So you have two hindrances, not just one. And then you notice that your mind is caught by thinking about this feeling and caught by thinking about a situation that's happened in the past. Now, as soon as you notice that, you let it go and you relax and come back to your object of meditation on the breath. In breath, relax. Out breath, relax. The hindrance is not going to go away easily. So what we have to do is learn how to not get involved in trying to control the hindrance. What we have to do is start picking up our awareness and seeing how this process works. Now, you have dislike arise. How did that happen? What happened first? What happened right after that? What happened after that? As you let go and relax and come back to your object to meditation, this comes and pulls your mind away again, It pulls it away in exactly the same way every time. How did it happen? What happened first? Oh, first there was a feeling arose. And right after that, there were some little thoughts about the feeling and the identification with the feeling. And then that feeling got bigger. And those thoughts got bigger. And the feeling got bigger. And the thoughts got bigger. And eventually I was pulled away completely. Now, when your mindfulness begins to get good, you will start seeing more and more subtle little things about the hindrance when it arises. And the thing that you'll notice always is the hindrance causes your mind to get tight and tense. What is that tightness and tension that arises in your head, in your mind? That tightness and tension that arises in your head, in your mind, is the I like, I don't like mind. That is what the Buddha called craving. What's the cause of suffering? Craving. It's craving and it's ego identification with thoughts and feelings. Now, every time you open up and relax, you're letting go of that craving and you're letting go of the identification with those thoughts and feelings. Just for a moment. And then you come back to the breath and immediately your mind whisks you off again. So you keep on doing this over and over. Now, when you have something that you're very much attached to, you have some dislike towards somebody, or you have some dissatisfaction in one way or another, you have fear arising, whatever the emotion is. When you have that I like, I don't like mind, that pushes against that hindrance. And when there's this push against the hindrance gets bigger and more intense. So, when you start opening up and letting go, the hindrance doesn't have anything to push against. And eventually it gets weaker and weaker and weaker until finally it doesn't arise anymore. And when it doesn't arise anymore, there's such a sense of relief. You have joy arising that's unbelievable. You start smiling whether you want to or not. You really feel happy. Now, what's actually happened? You've let go of craving. That's the third noble truth, isn't it? The cessation of suffering. You've let go of the suffering. And whenever you let go of the suffering, there's something else that takes its place. Nature does not like a vacuum. What takes its place is the opposite of suffering, which is happiness, joy. Now, when the joy arises, it's really strong. And you feel good. And that particular hindrance will not ever come up and bother you again. So what you're doing is learning how to purify your mind. You're letting go of these attachments. And your mind becomes more and more uplifted. Every time you let go of an attachment, your mind goes deeper into your meditation. Now, I've just been talking about the first jhana to you. The second jhana, the joy lasts longer. And the happiness, when that arises, the happiness in Buddhism is a feeling of complete comfort in your mind and in your body. And you feel more comfortable than you've ever felt before. And right after that comfortable feeling, then that tranquility comes in and your mind stays on the object of meditation for longer periods of time. No effort at all. Very easy. So, you stay with that and then you get up and you do some things. And the one of the things that I wanted to tell you was that there's no real difference between sitting meditation and everything else. There's still, you have to develop your mindfulness, so you see your mind and you see it grab onto things and cause your tightness and tension, and you can let it go with your daily activities. So when you're developing this jhana and you go deeper because you've let go of a hindrance, you'll stay in this for a period of time, and then you get out, and then another hindrance comes along, and now you have to work with that one. But it gets easier and easier because you're starting to see how the process works. You're starting to see it as a process, not as me personally. I'm not foolish enough to say, well, I haven't been angry for a long time, it's time for me to be angry. Nobody does that to themselves. It happens because the conditions are right for it to occur. And what you do with that in the present moment dictates what happens in the future. If you keep opening and relaxing and allowing and letting go of that identification with those thoughts and feelings, what you have to look forward to in the future is a clearer mind, a more open mind, and a happier mind. And that's what the Buddha taught. This is what meditation really is. It doesn't have anything to do with how deep my practice goes. It has to do with how clear your mind becomes as you keep opening and relaxing with your daily activities as well as with your practice, your sitting practice. So one, the essence of the Buddha's practice is to open up and let go of everything. Don't be attached. How many times have you heard that? Don't be attached. What does that mean? It means watch your mind, how your mind grabs onto these things, and begin to let them go and relax. With your daily activities, you come back to the breath one or two times. On the in-breath, relax. The out-breath, relax. You let go of immeasurable amounts of tension and stress, of dissatisfaction and dislike. You let go of all of that stuff. And when you do that, your mind stays more in a state of balance. And that is what the Buddha was talking about. Developing a mind that doesn't get so caught up in the I like, I don't like, in the emotional reaction to those thoughts and feelings. Letting go of that emotional reactions and keeping a balanced mind. That's the essence of the practice. Equanimity. It doesn't come right away, unfortunately. And unfortunately, meditation is hardest when you first begin, because your mind's running all over the place, just like it always does. And it's hard to, at first, see that and let it go and relax and come back. But as you start doing it, your progress in meditation will start to really improve quickly. Now, one of the disadvantages of this one-pointed concentration, in Thailand, in Burma, in Sri Lanka, they teach one-pointed concentration, and they will tell their students, yes, you can practice this, it'll take you between 10 and 15 years to develop it very well. And they're talking to monks. They're not talking to laymen. They're talking to monks. So you get an idea of how difficult this kind of practice is. With this kind of practice, with this tranquility meditation, it doesn't take very long, because you're you're starting to notice more and more how you cause your own pain. And you start to see, I'm giving myself a headache now. It's time to let go of that one and relax. How many times have you had the kind of day where you had 35 things you had to do and you only had 30 minutes to get them done? And you're running around and you do this and then you do that and you come back and you're jumping all over the place. This is called restlessness. And the way to overcome the restlessness is to stop and sit for 5 or 10 minutes, relaxing your mind, calming your mind, and then you become very efficient. Where before you were running from one task to the other, never finishing anything, never doing anything very well, now you calm your mind and did this, done. That, finished. That, finished. You become very efficient and you wind up with time left over. This is just a simple example of what happens when we get caught by one of the hindrances. And how we try to power our way through the hindrance instead of be aware, have your mindfulness picked up, and start letting go and relaxing so that your mind can be calm. And then you become very good at what you're doing while you're doing it. You're not thinking about 3 things ahead while you're doing this. So it's real important for your daily life. Being aware of what you're doing in the present moment, being aware of the pain that you're and dissatisfaction you're causing yourself. There's nobody out there that's causing you pain. You are causing it to yourself. By your liking and disliking mind, that craving mind, and identifying with those emotions whenever they arise. Now, anytime an emotional state arises, we always act in the same way every time that state arises. We react. We act in the same way. And what the Buddha is trying to teach us to do is not react, but respond. In other words, don't do the same thing that causes pain every time it comes up. Doesn't work. Try something new. In other words, put your attention and relax into these things. Learn how to see with a calm mind that doesn't have a lot of distracting thoughts in it. Now, I just got done doing a 2-week retreat in California where sitting was very, very easy. There were still hindrances arising. There were still problems that arose. But with the daily activities, seeing how mind works, keep on calming and relaxing, I didn't have wandering mind. I was in the present moment all of the time. I wasn't distracted, and I didn't have a lot of troubles while I was doing the retreat. And that's where we're trying to get to. It doesn't mean you don't have any thoughts at all. You still have thoughts, but these are more like observation thoughts. You still have to plan what you're going to do. You know, I've got to go shave today. Okay, but I don't have to think about it over and over and over again before I do it. One time, enough. Then, go do the action that needs to be done. There's not a lot of wasted mental energy when you have a calm mind. And that leads to happiness. And I'm not talking about giddy kind of laughing and party kind of happiness. I'm talking about the deep happiness of relief from suffering. as you continue on with your practice, you will go deeper and deeper. The hardest thing to do is get to the first jhana. Once you get to the first jhana, your practice really starts to build because your understanding becomes deeper. And your practice lasts for longer periods of time, and you'll start making more and more time to do the meditation because you feel like it, not because you have to, not because you really want to. You just, okay, let's just do that. I feel that I got some extra time. I can be peaceful, calm. And the effort becomes less and less. But we have to develop our patience. We have to develop that mind that is not pushing to get to the next level or depth of concentration. When you get to the third jhana doesn't have any joy in it anymore. You have happiness and you have equanimity of mind. And the happiness is that. It's like seeing a lake that doesn't have any ripples on it at all. Just perfect. That's what it feels like. There's no movements of mind, and there's complete comfort in your mind and in your body. Complete comfort. Now these hindrances will keep coming up when your mindfulness starts to slip, and they don't slip quite as easily now as they did before. But still, there'll be times when your mindfulness starts to dip a little bit, and one of these hindrances will rise, and now you see it and you let it go, and you don't get excited about it, and you just see it as it really is. It's just part of a process that you have to let go of. And as you go deeper, you'll get into the fourth jhana. And the fourth jhana has no happiness at all, but it has the highest feeling that you can attain, and that is equanimity. Your mind is such a state of balance that I could come up and cut you, and your mind would say, oh, that's a cut. It wouldn't get excited. It wouldn't dislike it. It would just notice it for what it is. Your mind is in a complete state of balance. And that's quite nice. This is a state where the Buddha, he praised this a lot, where your mind is very manageable and wieldy and pliable and all of these different things. You can do a lot once you get into the fourth jhana. Now the way Sariputta and Moggallana both attained Nibbana was through the mindfulness of breathing meditation. And they went through what is called the Arupa jhana, or the immaterial jhanas. As they get deeper in their meditation, they got to a state that's called infinite space. And when you get into the state called infinite space, what you do is you feel your mind expanding and expanding, and there's no limits at all. There's no center. There's just continual movement. And with that feeling of expansion, you start to realize one of the characteristics of all existence, and that is impermanence. There's nothing that's permanent. Everything is in a state of change, and it's continually changing. Because it's changing, and it changes a lot, and it changes quickly, there's an unsatisfactoriness that arises. It's kind of tiresome. And you see that you don't have any control over this change. It's changing all by itself. As you go deeper in your meditation, then you'll get into a space that's called infinite consciousness. And infinite consciousness is seeing consciousnesses arise and pass away fast. That means at each one of the sense doors, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, you're seeing consciousness arise and pass away, arise and pass away, arise and pass away, and it's happening really, really fast. And this is a time when a lot of my students will come to me and say, you know, this is tiresome, seeing this much change all the time, and knowing it's not me, it's not mine, I don't have any control over this at all. But as mind goes deeper, it will get to a space where the consciousness just fades away. And this is called the realm of nothingness. This is when mind is not looking outside of itself anymore. But there are still the five aggregates can arise. The seven factors of enlightenment can arise. If your mindfulness slips a little bit, one of the hindrances can arise. And this is when you start to walk a very, very fine line between having too much energy and not quite enough energy in your practice. And this is when you start fine-tuning. If you don't have quite enough energy in your practice, your mind becomes dull. And then you have to work with the dullness, letting it go, relaxing, coming back. And then you get back, and then you have too much energy, and it gets restless. And now you have to work with this hindrance, letting it go, calming, coming back. And you get to learn how that very fine-tune consciousness. And this is probably one of the most interesting states of meditation to be in. And there's nothing. Interesting. As you go deeper, you'll get to a place where you start feeling mind contract, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller until finally you can't tell whether it's there or not. And this is called being in the realm of neither perception nor non-perception. A way that this is described is there's two monks that are walking in the forest. And they walk over this little tiny stream, trickle of water. And the junior monk says to the senior monk, Bhante, I want to go back and get a drink of water. And the senior monk says, ah, water, get my towel, I want to take a bath. But the junior monk says, there's water, but there's not enough. Okay, there's consciousness, and it's there. And sometimes you can see it, sometimes you can't. Now what happens next is you keep on opening and relaxing, and you're calming your mind more and more. So your mind, when you first started meditating, it was running all over. And now you're getting so that it's barely vibrating at all. And finally you relax so much that it stops. And this is called the cessation of perception and feeling. This is not Nibbana. But this is where the perception and feeling stop. And it stops for a short period of time. When your mindfulness is good enough, and the perception and feeling come back, you will see dependent origination. You see, when ignorance arises, then your habitual habits arise. When your habitual habits arise, consciousness arises. When consciousness arises, mind and body arises. When mind and body arises, the sixth sense base arises. When the sixth sense base arises, contact arises. When contact arises, feeling arises. When feeling arises, craving arises. When craving arises, clinging arises. When clinging arises, being arises. When being arises, birth arises. When birth arises, old age, sickness, death, and all the other things arise. And you will see this. And then you will see when ignorance does not arise, then habitual habits don't arise. When habitual habits don't arise, then consciousness doesn't arise. And it'll go all the way through that. And finally, you'll get to the final letting go. And that's when Nibbana occurs. Now, a lot of people in the world have been told that you can't attain Nibbana, it's impossible, never going to happen, you have to wait till the next Buddha comes around before you can even think about it. Don't believe it. I just gave you a description of some of the experiences that you can have. And Nibbana is available. It depends on you. How much time you're willing to put in. How well do you follow the directions? And that's a big one. Especially in this country, my coming back after being in Asia for 12 years, I come back and I give people instructions in meditation and I come back 2 hours later and talk to them about what they're doing and they're not even paying attention to what I said. They're doing whatever they feel like. And then I say, well, okay, you can do that if you want, but you don't need me. So following the directions are very important. And the directions are simple. Whatever it is, let it go and relax. That's it. I say that in a thousand different ways, but it always comes back to the same thing. Let it go. Open up and relax. Now you see the difference between the one-pointed concentration where you have to contract your mind a little bit and focus. That extra step of relaxing allows you to be able to experience Nibbana. If you practice one-pointed concentration, it will never happen. And the people right now in this country that are practicing, quote, vipassana, cannot experience Nibbana. And they have their own made-up description of how you attain Nibbana. I practiced with them for 20 years. I went to Burma and I practiced very intensively. And I experienced what they said you were supposed to experience to attain Nibbana, and it is not. They will tell you that in order to attain Nibbana, what you have to do is see either impermanence or suffering or not self come up and go away very quick, 4 or 5 times, and then your mind blanks out. That's Nibbana. It doesn't agree with the original suttas at all. This is a commentary. And a lot of people have had this experience and they think they're enlightened. But there was no real personality change. They still get angry in the way they always got angry. They still have as much lust as they ever had before. But they're enlightened. See, the whole point of learning the Buddha's path is how to let go of all of the things that cause us pain and suffering. The lust, the hatred, the dissatisfaction, the restlessness, all of these, the fears, the anxieties. How to recognize that they cause us pain and how to let them go. That's what the Buddha's path is. With one-pointed concentration, your concentration goes so deep, pushes down all of those unwholesome mental states until you stop meditating and you get up and you have to live your daily life, and then you get attacked by them. But you don't really see them. Your mindfulness is not good enough. Okay, I've been talking for a long time, and I didn't really plan on talking this much. Do you have any questions? Is it clear what I'm talking about? No, you respond always by letting go of the tightness and relaxing and coming back to your meditation. That is what I have been running across in this country, and I'm starting to call it the Western disease. That is analyzing. And what you're doing is you're getting into your thinking mind. Yes. When you get involved with an emotion, you are identifying with the emotion as being yours personally. And it is not. That emotion arose because conditions were right for it to arise. What you do with it in the present moment dictates what happens in the future. If you get involved with it, that means your mind is tightening around it. I'm talking about subtle tightnesses, and I guarantee that it is. Then that emotion will not be there. No. You see what I'm saying? When you have a completely relaxed mind and body, your mind is in a state of equanimity, and that emotion is not going to arise at that time. If it does, there's nothing that's holding on to it, and it doesn't matter. Okay, so this emotion is there. So it's there. It doesn't make your mind wobble. It doesn't make your mind move when you have this kind of tranquility that I'm talking about. Okay, you're talking about thinking about your feeling. And those are the five aggregates right there. No. Okay, let's see what Dhamma is in the sutta, okay? Dhamma in the sutta is five hindrances, five aggregates, six sense base, seven factors of enlightenment. Of course, all of these are not self. just because we say it doesn't mean we really know that for a fact. Every time you let go and relax and don't get involved in analyzing, in trying to control, in trying to see where it comes from, just let it be, and you relax and come back to your object of meditation, that hindrance will get a little smaller and a little smaller and eventually will fade away. And you can say it's hard. It's only as hard as you are attached to it. You see? When you're really attached to something, yeah, it's hard to let it go. But the reason that it's hard is because you're holding on so tightly. And you're identifying with it so much. Now, one of the things that I teach people is loving kindness meditation. And one of the things that I tell these people is most people that meditate are way too serious. And a serious mind is a hard mind. So what I tell them to do when an emotional state arises and it's hard to let go of it, laugh at yourself for being caught. When you can laugh, I mean sincerely laugh at yourself, then it's not my emotion anymore, it's only this. It's not my anger, it's only anger. And it's very easy to let go of it right then. It's easier. I should have said by not getting involved with it, by not wanting it to go away, just by allowing it to be and take your attention and redirect it back to your object of meditation after you relax. Now we're talking about hindrances here. All of these things are hindrances. It's softening into it and relaxing, not trying to control. This is what we get caught with because we want to make it do what we want when we want it to do it. Okay? And what we want to do is let go of that want to make it any different than it already is. Now, when you're sitting in meditation and you have your leg go to sleep and it's painful, what do you do with that pain? Oh, I get up and move. I don't want that pain. Or you can soften your mind and allow that sensation to be there without trying to control it. And you'll find that if you get good at it, that will not be a disturbance to you at all. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the way that people are practicing the Vipassana right now, and they are probably the most confused meditators that I've ever run across. Because they're identifying with all of these thoughts and feelings as long as they're there. They're not... No, you're not suppressing. You're not suppressing. You're allowing it to be there, but you're not giving it any energy. When you look at it, you're giving it energy. I'll give you an example of this. When you're practicing Vipassana and a pain arises, they tell you to put your attention right in the middle of that pain. And what happens? That pain becomes so big. And what am I saying? When you have that pain and you put your attention in the middle of it, that pain becomes big, what does your mind do? And you don't even see it. And what does that do to your personality? Now, eventually you can watch that pain until it goes away, but you still have that hard mind. People that practice Vipassana the way it's being taught right now have a tendency to have very critical minds, and they're very prideful. I know, and you don't know. Okay? They're not seeing that. They're not seeing that attachment. They're not seeing that false identification with those thoughts and feelings. Now, when I'm teaching, what I'm saying is that pain comes, you don't put your attention into the middle of it, you open up and relax into it. It doesn't matter whether it's an emotional pain or a physical pain. You treat it in the same way. Open, relax, calm. Come back to your object of meditation. Open, relax. Oops, you went back to it. Okay, do the same thing again and again and again until your mind doesn't wobble. That pain can go away or not. But what happens in your mind is the thing that's most important. And the way that the meditation is being taught right now is that you grit your teeth and it doesn't matter how big the pain is, you have to sit with it. I did that for 20 years. I had pain so intense, it was like somebody had a hot needle that was sticking it in the middle of my head. I had tears coming down my face. I didn't move. I watched it till it went away. And my mind became so hard and so tight because of that, I'm still trying to get it loosened. Because I was told you don't move. I follow the instructions. When I was in Burma, I was an advanced meditator. I could sit for 2 or 3 hours without any problem at all. And I went to this one teacher and he said, "How long are you sitting?" And I said, "I'm sitting 2 hours. I walk for an hour." "Oh, why don't you sit longer?" "Okay, I will." Next day I come back. "How long are you sitting?" "3 hours." "Walk for an hour." "Oh, that's good. Why don't you sit longer?" "Okay." I come back the next day, 4 hours. "Did you move?" "Yes, it was painful." "Don't move." "Okay. And while you're at it, why don't you sit longer?" Now, he pushed me, and I had very strong equanimity of mind. There was a lot of pain, but it didn't matter. And I was sitting 7-8 hours, and I did it for about a month. Now, my body was used to sitting like that, and I have phlebitis because of it. I have, from here down, I have bad circulation. Both legs. Because the teacher told me that this is what I had to do, and I followed the directions completely. And do I teach that way now? No. When I teach, I tell you, sit for a half an hour. You have to sit for a half an hour. Don't move. And when your sitting is good, sit longer. That's natural. Burmese don't do things in a natural way. They do things in a pushing way. And that's who I was practicing with, so that's what I got to do.
Yeah.
Huh? Right. Right. See, your mind is on your object of meditation, and it gets distracted. You let go of the distraction and immediately come back. That leads to one-pointed concentration. If you let go and relax and come back, that's tranquility. You'll go deeper, but you'll go into the tranquility instead of the one-pointed concentration. That one extra step changes everything. Not just a little bit, changes it a lot. No. Not when you're relaxing. You'll have a kind of concentration, but it's not the same. And it's not nearly as deep. When you get into one-pointed concentration, it pushes down and stops part of your experience from coming up. But with this kind of meditation, when your mindfulness wobbles a little bit and gets tired, then you have these other things coming up that you have to work with, and that's how you purify your mind. Yeah. Don't scratch. But watch what your mind does with it. Watch how your mind tightens around it and thinks about it and tries to think the itch away. The more your mind thinks about the itch, the bigger the itch becomes, and you can't stand it. It will turn it into an emergency, so you have to move in your own mind. So what you do is you let go of the thoughts about it and relax and let go of the tight mental hold. And then it becomes bearable. Now this happens, say you're going to cough. What happens when you feel a cough coming on? I don't want that to happen. Tightness. And the thoughts about it. So you let go of the thoughts and relax, and if your body's going to cough, let it cough. It's okay. But let it be on automatic. Don't resist anything. There's an acronym that works very well, and it's DROPS, drops. Don't resist or push. Soften. But for people that I teach loving kindness to, I say, don't resist or push, smile. Because when you smile into things, then they stop being such an emergency. I have students right now that when they sit in meditation, they can sit for 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, but it's no effort to them at all. And I don't insist that people sit on the floor. Sitting in a chair is fine. I mean, in Asia, during the time of the Buddha, everybody sat on the floor because nobody had any chairs. So you're used to sitting on the floor. In this country now, you're not. And it can cause a lot of pains to arise. I had one student in Malaysia that she was very virtuous, very good person, very kind, very helpful. And she did a retreat with me. And the first day of the retreat, I went to her and I said, how long are you sitting? And she said, only 45 minutes. And I said, why don't you sit longer? And she said, the pain was too intense. I can't sit any longer than 45 minutes. So I said, okay, go sit in a chair. Her next sitting was 4 hours. And it was natural. You don't have to sit on the floor to practice meditation. If you want to, that's fine. You're on an airplane for 9 or 10 or 11 hours, you're not really meditating. So get up and walk around. And you should do that every couple hours. You can, but you're not going to be able to do it for 10 or 11 hours. Then get up and move. We're talking about different things completely, you know? You're talking about a physiological phenomenon that has nothing to do with mind, and I'm talking about mind, and that makes a difference. Physiology is one thing, but when you put mind into on top of that, the Buddha sat for 7 days. 7 days. Not moving. One of my teachers could sit for 7 days not moving. Healthy. No problem. She did. He didn't have any chairs to sit in. But my teacher did. She was in India and she sat in a chair for 7 days. She didn't move. Okay.
When you say let go of the hindrance, you will automatically feel joy. Would this joyful feeling then create simultaneously a new attachment? Or this is the natural joy without attachment?
All feeling you treat in the same way. Pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, neutral feeling. And how do you do that? Unpleasant feeling, you relax, let go, come back to your object of meditation. Pleasant feeling, you relax, let go, come back to your object of meditation. Neutral feeling, you relax, let go, come back to your object of meditation. When joy arises, you treat it like any other feeling. You won't be attached to it. You stay with your object of meditation. If you want that joy to go away quickly, try to hold on to it. It just doesn't work. But if you want the joy to stay around, you watch your object of meditation very closely. And when your energy starts to dip just a little bit, you pick up your energy and watch a little bit more closely, and that joy will stay for a longer period of time. But that doesn't mean you're attached to it. Attachment means tightness. It means a grasping mind. When you have craving, that is the I like, I don't like mind. When you have clinging, that means the thoughts about the like or dislike. And you're letting go of all of that by staying with your object of meditation. That's it. Just this one. Just do the mindfulness of breathing, the instructions I already gave you. I'll give them to you again if you want. At first. But as you get better at doing it, it gets easier. That's the beauty of it. And that's the hard part of it, too. Because when you first start out, your mind's going to run around like a mad monkey. But as your mind becomes more used to coming back to your object of meditation and becoming more calm, it will naturally start to tend towards that. One of the things that the Buddha said was, what you think and ponder on, that is the inclination of your mind. Okay, when you ponder on having tranquility, having peace, and you do that over and over again, your mind will tend towards that. And it really works that way. Now with this technique, if you're serious and you practice at least an hour a day, you can reasonably assure yourself that you'd be able to attain a jhana within 6 weeks. Not 10 or 15 years. But that means really doing it. That's it. How simple. Isn't it amazing? There's so many meditations that are so complicated. And the Buddha came along and said, just do this. That's all. And you have to understand, he had to be successful to be as popular as he was. And he was teaching ignorant farmers. And they were successful. So he had to have a simple method that everyone could understand. And the one-pointed concentration gets a little bit tricky. But the tranquility meditation, it doesn't. It's just the same thing with everything that arises. Okay. Okay. Yeah. But I tell you, just do one kind of meditation at a time. Become very good at that. Now, the reason I like to practice the loving-kindness meditation and the reason I like to teach it is because your progress in loving-kindness meditation is faster than any other kind of meditation that you can do, because you're working with opening up your heart. You're working with this feeling. And you can see your heart close much more quickly than you can see your mind close. Your choice. Well, there can be a group energy that's very nice. And now if you have one person or two people that are really serious with the practice and they do it a fair amount, and you come in and you sit with them in the group, their tranquility will kind of transfer over to you and you'll feel more peaceful and calm. When I was doing the retreat in California, my friend, I was doing it at his house. My friend would every now and then come into the meditation room and he said, it's like walking into a void. There's nothing there. It's just so quiet. And his meditation took off. His meditation was very good. Yeah. Start looking at the advantages of doing it. Start noticing how, with your daily activities, you start to relax into situations that used to get you upset. And when you start seeing that more clearly, that will give you more more encouragement to continue. And it is kind of amazing. When I was in Malaysia, I would I'd take on a class of 15 or 20 people, and they would really get into it. And then these people would come up to me and they say, "All of my friends are telling me I'm different now. And they like me more." Good. That's what the meditation's all about. Be happy. That's the right direction. If you want to see if a teacher is good or not, look at his students. You want to see if a teacher really knows how to uplift your mind, you look at his students and see if their mind is uplifted, if they're happy. That's the key. Okay? Now let's share some merit then. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu.
The following are instruction given to students in a retreat on March the 10th, year 2001. How many jhanas are there? And this first question. Second one is, right before entering the very first jhana, what are the physical changes in terms of, whatever, physical transformation? Could you kindly tell us about it?
Technically, there are only four jhanas, but the fourth jhana can be subdivided into four. So quite often, people will say that there are eight jhanas. And the last, right after you go through all of the jhanas, you get to a stage that's called neither perception nor non-perception, and some people call that a jhana. So that would be nine. So, technically, there's only four jhanas. And when you get to the fourth jhana, you have only equanimity in your mind. And with that equanimity, there's four subsections that you can get into. And then there's the cessation of perception and feeling. Now, as far as what kind of things you go through with right before you get into the first jhana, generally speaking, what you're doing is you're working with one of the hindrances. You're working with a distraction. And as the distraction gets weaker and weaker, you keep on opening and letting go and opening and letting go. And when you finally let go of that, then your mind has a very strong sense of relief. And it's like someone takes a big weight off of your shoulders. And then you have this joy that's uplifting joy and the happiness and unification of mind after that. No, that's part of the jhana. See, the first jhana has five different things in it. It's called thinking, examining, joy, happiness, and unification of mind, or the tranquility. Okay?
Master, when you told us yesterday, we have to keep the mind relaxed and let it go. And we don't have to focus anything else. But if we don't do it, everything is come in. How we can help us to keep the mind clear and don't focus in anything? Maybe I think if we should focus in some image or some question or just nothing.
You have a wrong idea. You focus on your object of meditation. Your object of meditation is the breath, and on the in-breath you relax, on the out-breath you relax. So it's not nothing that you're focusing on. You're not just continually sitting there opening and relaxing with nothing to keep your mind on. You're always coming back to the breath. On the in-breath, you relax. On the out-breath, you relax. But you're using the breath as your reminder to relax. So you're not over-focusing on the breath. Okay? So that you do have an object of meditation. If you don't use an object of meditation, your mind will run all over everywhere. And you wind up becoming more confused. So you always have to come back to your home base. And your home base is your object of meditation. And the object of meditation is the breath and relaxing. Okay?
I have also some other questions. When the feelings and perception totally stop, that kind of a special jhana, how long can that last? And the person will not die physically. And how, since the person does have no feeling or perception, which thing or what factors will bring the meditator back to normal life, normal feeling and perception?
Okay, we're talking about very high state here. And when the feeling and perception stop, it only happens for a short period of time, 5 minutes, 6 minutes, like that. And the feeling and perception automatically come back by themselves. Now, when a person gets to the third stage of enlightenment or becomes an arahat, they will be able to develop this state of mind to a very fine degree, and they can sit for 7 days. And that's the longest that anyone can sit, is 7 days. Otherwise, body dies. Now, I've heard claims of some Hindu yogis that they sat for 21 days, and I have real trouble believing that. Now, there was a monk in Thailand that he had very deep concentration, and he started sitting, and he died in the sitting position because he sat too long. So, 7 days is the longest that anyone can sit without having a feeling and perception come back.
About this high level, I guess That's one of our goals. Is this high level of jhana in Chinese called mie shou xiang ding achievable by one-pointness meditation, or that's unique to Buddhist only?
It's unique to Buddhist only. You cannot get to it by one-pointed concentration. The highest you can get is neither perception nor non-perception. See, when the Buddha was a bodhisattva in his last lifetime, he tried many, many different ways to attain nibbana. And he went as far as you possibly could go with every way that he tried. And like when he was not taking very much food, he was just taking a few grains of food a day. And he fainted, and his skin turned black, and he said if he touched his stomach area, he would touch his spine. That means he didn't have very much meat there. There wasn't much body there at all. When he fainted, there were devas, heavenly beings, that thought that he had died, and he'd become an arahat because he'd not eaten for such a long period of time. And what came into his mind when he gained his consciousness again is, I've gone as far as I can. No one could ever go any further without taking food. And this is not nibbana yet. And that's why he started taking food again. But he did that with every kind of meditation, including the one-pointed concentration. The first teacher he went to, he got to the realm of nothingness. And that's as far as that teacher could take him. He went to another teacher, he got to the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, and that's as far as that teacher could take him. And it wasn't nibbana. So then he started practicing the tranquility and attained it by himself.
Maybe I'll come back to this high-level questions, which were not there, far away from that. So let's come back to some fundamental questions. What are the and the practical questions? What are the common problems that enable a person, a beginner meditator, to enter into the very first jhana, from your experience?
Well, for everybody, the common problem is a noisy mind, an active mind. That is part of restlessness, which is one of the hindrances. And the hindrances can come to you in any form. You can be sitting and all of a sudden you can have a lot of sadness. Or you can be sitting and all of a sudden you feel very angry. Or you have fear arise. Now these are all different kinds of hindrances. And this is what we have to learn how to let go of. When you let go of the hindrances, your mind will go deeper in your meditation, and then you can expect to attain the jhana.
If we cannot let go of that one, can we, in practicing of this method, tranquil meditation, tranquil wisdom meditation,